I'm Hakeem Adebutu. I'm a poet. My birth name was Donnell Lee, and the name was changed in 1974 to better reflect who I actually am, a man of African ancestry. I'm a poet, a husband and father. My wife is Dr. Carol Lee, who is a professor in the School of Education in Chicago at Northwestern University. In fact, she has an endowed chair at Northwestern. Institution builder. I founded Third World Press in 1967 in my basement apartment, which is about the size of this table that I share with other unwanted animals.
And it's grown?
It's grown to where it's the premier independent black book publishing company in the world. So in September of this year, we'll be 45 years old in terms of publishing company. I've published 31 books. Most are books of poetry. Mm-hmm. But the one book that has sold over a million copies was prose. It's titled Black Men, Obsolete, Single, Dangerous, The African-American Family in Transition. It came out in 90-something. I've traveled to every and read poetry in every state in the Union, except Alaska, Hawaii, and North Dakota and South Dakota. I've had the opportunity to travel around many of the independent African nations. In fact, my wife and I are getting ready to go to South Africa in September. My life has been around, one of my titles of one of my books is Liberation Narratives. And I think that any people who are in control of their own cultural imperatives are about creating a liberation narrative that essentially allow them to rise to a state in the world where they are not forever making excuses why they're here. Okay, that as all human beings, we're here for a purpose. And I felt that my purpose has been to essentially protect and promulgate the culture and to bring about healthy lives.
I have to ask, though.
Yeah, that's fine.
Such a busy, busy life. Mm-hmm. Do you still find time to write?
I write every day.
Good for you.
And this is why we've been able to, I think, stay alive at one level. And most certainly why I've been able to stay alive. Turned 70 years old February 23rd of this year. And what keeps me alive are several things. One, the poetry itself. I read as much as I write. I read every day. And I have several libraries. I mean, this is part of my personal library. And at our home, we have a major library. And so literature has informed my life, foundationally, most certainly of black literature, but as I grew and read and traveled, then world literature has become part of my life. So writing, I rise early. I rise generally somewhere between 5:30 and 6, and do whatever cleanup I need to do, and drinking my liquids, and then I'll walk about 5 miles. And I write in my head all the time, so as I walk, I'm writing. Okay, and when I come back to the house, I'll put those ideas down on, you know, newspaper. I still write in longhand, so I use a legal pad for the most part. And so somewhere between a couple hours a day, and that's generally pretty much every day. Writing to me is like breathing. It's like almost like walking.
But I have to
writing. I still have that juice. I'm not going to probably do another memoir. That's up to 20. Yellow Black is 21 years. And so that just took me up to 1963.
Yeah.
So how am I going to do from 63 to 2012 or 13?
During which more than two things happened.
Yeah. So I don't know if I'm going to do it or not.
Yeah.
But Liberation Narratives, if you want to look at a poet's actual autobiography, look at this poetry, her poetry. And so you would see it in liberation narratives. And even in writing Yellow Black, I would go back to the early poetry and just look at it, even though I didn't start really writing poetry seriously until I was around 17, 18 years old. I had started reading prior to writing. I started reading seriously at 14. I read Blackwell with Richard Wright at 14 years old.
And Little Rock?
No, I was in Detroit.
Oh.
I was born in Little Rock,
right.
Arkansas. But we left Little Rock before I was 1 year old. So as John Killen said, we moved up south. to Detroit.
Well, Arkansas still claims you.
Yeah, it does. Yeah. In fact, I was inducted into the Black Hall of Fame, Little Rock Hall of Fame, with Bill Clinton. In fact, he was inducted at the same time I was, and Little Rock, the city itself, I got the keys to the city and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. Yellow Black, my memoir, is really about my mother and my sister. And I as a storyteller. Two very beautiful women. My mother was so beautiful, she not only stopped cars, she stopped buses. But shortly after I arrived, she was on her own with my sister and I. And because of her beauty, and without any serious formal education, she ended up in the sex trade. And she was brought into the sex trade by black ministers. And I write about all that in Yellow Black. But by the time she was 34, she was dead. But she had succumbed to drugs and alcohol, but she was actually murdered. And which at one level kind of detailed my life to be, because I saw what drugs and alcohol did to her. And I never wanted to put myself in that position. Even 3 years in the military, I never drank or smoked. And so I've been on this health avenue all my adult life.
Do you remember any early times of writing when you were a kid?
Oh, sure. I would write in high school.
Yeah.
And as a poet. But at that time, it was not the best thing for a black boy to be a poet.
Right, right.
And so when the brothers would look over my shoulder and say, "Well, Don, what are you doing?" I said, I'm writing lyrics for the Miracles or the Supremes or the Four Tops, you know. Yeah. But writing and literature, when I read Black Boy by Richard Wright at 14, it was a book that essentially opened me up to the world that I was familiar with, but I couldn't articulate because I didn't have the tools to articulate. But reading Richard Wright saved my life because I read it in less than 24 hours. Gave it to my mother the next day, and she's the one who forced me to go get the book. And I really refused to go check out Black Boy at a white librarian because I did not want to go to a white librarian for a book with black in the title by an author who was critical of white America. That's how much I hated myself.
Yeah.
But I went, and I found the book on the shelf and put it to my chest and walked to an unpeopled section of the library and sat down and began to read. And for the first time in my life, I was reading literature that was not an insult to my own personhood. And that's what brought me into this world of literature. And Richard Wright's book, White Man Listen, which is a book of essays, had an essay in it on black literature. And when I consumed that essay, that opened up the world of black writers. And I systematically, you know, started reading every writer that he mentioned and that he referenced in that essay. And that started my life. That's when I started writing. What happened with the books I was reading from Richard Wright on, I would write a 250-word essay on each book. Okay, but this was prose, not poetry. And when I finished high school and did not have any place to go because I didn't have family other than my sister, I joined a magazine selling group with two cars and about 8 teenagers and 2 adults, traveling through southern Illinois, stopping in small towns, selling magazine subscriptions. This was 1960.
Boy, time of change.
And all I owned I had with me, which was basically one suit that I had for my mother's funeral and one coat, and about five to ten books, and, you know, underwear and stuff like that. Stopped in Springfield, Illinois, and knocked on this door, and this very distinguished black man answered the door. And my lie was I was working my way through Howard University selling these subscriptions. And I'd never been to D.C., nor to Howard, but I had read Elaine Locke, who's a philosopher at Howard. I had read E. Franklin Frazier. I had read Rayford Logan, who's a historian at Howard. I had read these men. And so I could, you know, my lie was halfway plausible. But the man that answered the door, very distinguished and elderly man, was a Howard Law School graduate. And so I went into my lie, and he invited me in and, you know, looked at me and knew I was hungry and said, "I want something to eat." And he asked me a couple of questions which I could not answer with any kind of authority. And then he said, "You're not really a student at Howard." I said, "No, sir, I'm not. I'm just trying to make a living selling these magazine subscriptions." He said, "Well," and he gave me some advice. He first said, "Well, are you hungry?" And obviously I was. And his wife fixed me a sandwich and gave me a drink. And he said that one of the few things that no one could ever take from me is an education. And what you have to be aware of is that what's happening now is all across the country, these community colleges are opening up. And these community colleges are for people without serious resources. So you should consider going to a community college. I said, "Yes, sir." He bought a couple of subscriptions to magazines, and I got up to leave. I'm walking toward the door, and he said, "Son," you know, and I kept walking. And he said, "Son," and he said, "Young man, wait a minute." So no one ever called me son before. So I wasn't responding to that, you know, loving term. And he said, he went into his pocket and pulled out his wallet. And I was watching, took out a $20 bill. And he folded it in quarters and said, "Put this in your wallet and keep it for an emergency." Now, this, the interesting thing about this is, and this is what it really helped me in terms of me my becoming the man I am today. This was a stranger. I never met him before. But he's a black man. And he took time with me, he fed me, he gave me advice, he bought the magazines, and then gave me $20. At that time, $20 a day was about $150, $200 a day, right? And as I walked out, you know, tears were coming out of my eyes because I had never been treated that way before in such a loving way, and most certainly by a stranger. I had been treated that way by family. Right? So I never forgot that. And we moved on into East St. Louis and stayed at a hotel there, and I got very ill from the bad food, and the people that I was traveling with, they left me. Mm. So I was able to use the $20 in about a week or so to pay the hotel bill and go on to St. Louis, and I decided, since I did not have, you know, I'm literally by myself, I don't have anything except what I'm carrying to wear.
And you're how old?
I'm 18.
Yeah.
And I go to the poor man's bank and I pawn my horn, a trumpet, flugelhorn, and I pawn my suit. And then I went to, I joined the Army. See, the Army at that time, as is today, with the poor boys or poor girls, answered unemployment. Mm-hmm. And this is why I say that if you talk about class warfare, let's talk about fighting these wars. That's class warfare.
Yeah.
And so I joined the military. And on my way to basic training, I'm reading Paul Robeson's Here I Stand, which is a memoir of Paul Robeson and the trials and tribulations which he underwent here in this country. Got to basic training, just three black men and the rest white men. And I get off the bus and I got Paul Robeson's book in my hand with this, you know, big black magnificent face on the book. And the drill sergeant sees Paul Robeson's face, he's about 30-something. And Paul Robeson was the first, one of the most famous black people we ever produced. And of course, he had to deal with the House of Un-American Activities as well as Du Bois. He snatched the book out of my hand and said, "You know, what's your Negro mind doing reading that black communist?" Of course, I first time I heard double negative use of creatively. Right? And so he said, all you women up against the bus. Now, there are no women there. This is 1960, all right? And he held my book over his head, and he commenced to tear the pages out of each out of the book and gave a page to each of the groups that uses for toilet tissue. At that point, I said, what am I doing here, number one? And number two, I said, what can I learn from this? And what I learned was that I'm a man of African ancestry. I'm a black man in America, even though I'm this color, and I would never apologize for that ever again. Number two, I realized the importance of ideas, that ideas, that the creators of ideas and the carriers of ideas run the world. And we all tap dance to somebody's ideas. If you're Christian, that's an idea. If you're Muslim, that's an idea. If you're Sikh, if you're Buddhist, these are ideas. If you're Democrat, Republican, a member of the Communist Party, a Socialist Party, those are ideas. In fact, if you're a member of the Sugar Hill Gang, that's an idea. That ideas are powerful. So I decided at that young age and that morning at basic training that I'm going to join the idea business. I'm not going to be digging ditches for these people. I'm not going to be on some, you know, some assembly line at Ford or Chrysler. Then I'm going to get into the idea business. And for the 2 years and 10 months that I spent at basic at the United States Army, I read close to a book a day. And in reading those books, I write a 250-word essay for each book. And that's how, when I came out, I was able to go to college on the, I went to community college on the GI Bill, then 4-year college, and then ended up in academia. But all the time I'm writing and sending out poems, and the poems are being rejected for any number of reasons. And we said, I need to, you know, my mentors, people who mentored me, are Malcolm X, Elwyn Smith, Margaret and Charlie Burroughs, who founded, that's them right there, they founded the DuSable Museum here in Chicago, which is the first black museum in the country. They founded it. And I found them on a sojourn to Chicago. I was stationed at Arlington Heights and then Fort Sheridan here in Illinois. And I was going about to go crazy. I'm in the military. And I found them, and they took me in as a son. And then a man by the name of Dudley Randall, who was the founder of Broadside Press, which is published to come out of Detroit, Michigan, and one of the most finest poets that we produce in our culture also. He became a mentor. As well as Hort W. Fuller, who was a managing editor of Negro Digest Black World Magazine, which was published by Johnson Publishing Company, who publishes Ebony and Jet. The Black World Magazine, Negro Digest Magazine, it was Negro Digest and changed the name later to Black World Magazine, was the most influential black literary magazine and political magazine to come out of our culture for about 20 years. And he became a mentor to me. Then there was Barbara Ann Sizemore, one of the premier educators in the country. She was the first black superintendent of schools in Washington, D.C. Mm. And during the period that she was there at D.C. as a superintendent, I was on the faculty at Howard University, which was interesting also. I lied about going to Howard, but eventually they gave me a job.
Because you sold subscriptions to the right man.
Yeah, well, mainly, but primarily because in 1969, I got a position at Cornell University as black poet in resident at Cornell. And Ebony Magazine did a feature on me. And then my third book came out, Don't Cry Scream, and it sold about 75,000 copies. And that's why Howard called me. Mm-hmm. And then after Hort Fuller was the woman who essentially became my cultural mother for over 33 years, Gwendolyn Brooks. I met Gwendolyn Brooks. She had a writing workshop mainly dealing with the Blackstone Rangers here in Chicago. And we had already formed OBICE, Organization of Black American, Organization of Black American Culture, Writers Workshop here in Chicago. And so I and some other poets one Saturday morning went to meet Gwendolyn Brooks. She was the premier black poet in the country. I always say that we went that week, that Saturday morning, and I ended up staying, you know, because she was so giving and so loving and so supportive, you know. the third book I mentioned, Don't Cry Scream, she wrote the introduction to it. Okay. There's so much, but the writing and the poetry and my community work has basically been my life.
Right? Do you do much revision when you write?
All the time.
All the time.
Well, 90% of the writing is revision.
Yeah?
Yeah. Pretty much so. The four things I tell young people when I would teach writing. One, read. Now, you really can't understand the craft of writing unless you read. You really can't. Yeah. I mean, you read in your discipline, you read within the context of your culture, and then at a certain point you begin to expand. And read outside your culture, read outside your discipline. But if you're going to be a poet, then you need to know poetry. Okay, read. Second, write. What to write? I mean, try to write every day. And I would counsel at that time you carry notebooks around with you. Just carry a notebook you can put in your pocket. And when you hear something, write it down. Because write is still, just like everybody else. You write it down. And thirdly, is revision. Is revision. Is that you're going to revise as much as you are trying to create. And then the fourth avenue toward becoming, I think, a serious writer is workshop. Workshop. And this is the workshop is the only time that you're essentially in community with other writers. So most of the time, for the writer, he or she will be by him or herself creating.
Yes, we live in caves.
But you have to at some point, because writing, you're not trying to just write to yourself or just for yourself, you're trying to write for the population. So you need to have feedback from other like-minded people. And most certainly, even from not only young writers or writers your age, we need to be around senior writers and around people that understand writing, what good writing is.
So here you are as a writer, a publisher, certainly a reader and an educator. Do you have any insights about where it's all going to go with this technology and culture changes we're seeing? What do you think the future is going to be for writers?
I'm on the board of the Independent Book Publishing Association, which is the largest body group representing independent publishers, about 3,000 publishers. And generally, they ask publishers to serve a 3-year term. Mm-hmm. And they've asked me to serve another term. So I'm doing 6 years with them. We meet 4 times a year, generally on the West Coast. That's where the headquarters is. And so we pondered this deep question. Obviously, e-books have come in with everything from Amazon with this tablet and Barnes & Noble with Nook, iPad, and other electronic tablets. It's already gone there. It's not where it's going. It's already there.
Right.
All right. And so even here at Third World Press, we're looking at maybe 50 of our books that we're turning now into e-books. Okay. We will always, as long as I'm alive, do what we call traditional publishing in terms of books and press and so forth. Now, the way the industry has changed, say for instance, if we decide to publish a poet or a fiction writer or a literary nonfiction writer or a political writer, the way publishing is today, the way printing is today, print on demand, you got 48 hours print, you can get a book back in 7 days now. So we don't have to keep large inventories anymore,
right? Okay,
which is wise. And we could print according to what we think will sell quickly. Mm-hmm. So you're not keeping these large inventories. So printing as well as the move toward digital, and even printing is going on digital. Okay, so it's not, you still have the large letterpress and stuff like that, but you have now stuff is just really, they have machines now about the size of this table that would do the whole book.
Right.
You just put it in one end, you come out, you got the finished product.
And you have covered all of the basics that I can think of, so you have a thought.
Is there anything else you want to add? Well, other writers and readers?
I read your letter to me, and so I saw what you all were doing, so this is one reason I said, yes, I admire what you're doing. I think that one of the, if there's indeed a saving grace for this country, it would be by literate people like yourself.
Exactly.
That you cannot have an advanced culture, a population, without people who are advanced readers. And we writers, we poets, we artists, a part of our responsibility is to not only motivate, but be the carriers of this culture, the carriers of that which is true. And that's what I believe in, that which is good, that which is true, that which is correct, and that which is right. That's my religion. All right. Liars will not have safe coverage in my sphere of influence. And so I think that we outnumber those people who wish to do bad in the world.
It's just we don't.